Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Evidence-Based Strategies for Treatment and Surveillance of Differentiated Thyroid Cancer, a Patient's Perspective, which is certified by Medscape and presented by R. Michael Tuttle, MD, Kenneth D. Berman, MD, and Stephanie L. Lee, PhD, MD. Dr. Tuttle is a professor of medicine, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, New York, New York. Dr. Tuttle has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Genzyme Corporation, Abbott Laboratories, and Novo Nordisk. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Genzyme Corporation and Abbott Laboratories. He received grants for clinical research from Genzyme Corporation. Dr. Tuttle does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Tuttle does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Berman is a professor, Department of Medicine, Georgetown University, Chief Endocrine Section, Washington Hospital Center, Washington, D.C. Dr. Berman has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He received grants for clinical research from Pfizer and Amgen. Dr. Berman does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Berman does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Lee is an associate professor of medicine, Boston University School of Medicine, director, Thyroid Health Center, Boston Medical Center, Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Lee has disclosed no relevant financial relationships. Dr. Lee does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Lee does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to provide expert insight into the evidence-based management of differentiated thyroid cancer with a particular emphasis on individualized management planning. This activity is supported by Genzyme. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, my name is Dr. Michael Tuttle. I'm a professor of medicine and an endocrinologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City in New York. It's my sincere pleasure to welcome you to this roundtable discussion entitled Evidence-Based Strategies for Treatment and Surveillance of Differentiated Thyroid Cancer, a Patient's Perspective. I'm honored to be joined today by two of my colleagues in the field of endocrinology and thyroid cancer. To my immediate right, we have Dr. Stephanie Lee, an associate professor of medicine at Boston University School of Medicine and director of the Thyroid Health Center at Boston Medical Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Lee, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Mike.
I'm also very pleased to introduce Dr. Kenneth Berman, director of endocrinology at Washington Hospital Center in Washington, D.C. Dr. Berman, welcome to our program today.
Thank you, Mike.
The goal of today's discussion is to provide expert insight into the evidence-based management of differentiated thyroid cancer with a particular emphasis on individualized management planning. That is, making specific treatment and follow-up recommendations for patients based on an estimate of their individual risk for recurrence or death from thyroid cancer. Also, we will examine benefits and risk of various treatments commonly used in thyroid cancer management, including radioactive iodine, thyroid hormone withdrawal, levothyroxine suppressive therapy, and recombinant human TSH. To start, I'd like to show you a short clip of a patient diagnosed with differentiated thyroid cancer as she begins to describe her journey as a thyroid cancer survivor. We will be referring back to her story intermittently during our discussion today.
My name is Lisa. I was born in Italy. I now live in Rhode Island. I'm a mother of three boys. I'm here today to tell my story of surviving thyroid cancer and how I cope every day with the fact that I was diagnosed with thyroid cancer. My physician told me that it was papillary carcinoma, which I didn't understand exactly what that meant. In normal terms, I really didn't know what the next step was. I knew I needed to have surgery. I knew we needed to take out this gland, and I knew I had to go on a hormone replacement for the rest of my life so that hormone replacement would do the work that my thyroid used to do. During my surgery, the thyroid was completely removed, along with several lymph nodes, because when he went in, although he couldn't see it from the ultrasound and biopsy, he felt that certain lymph nodes looked suspicious. It turns out after they were tested, after the surgery, that they were fine.
So, like most patients diagnosed with thyroid cancer, Lisa has many, many important questions that need to be answered. The first question is often, what are the next steps and where do I go from here? Dr. Lee, what do you tell folks?
The first thing I tell patients is actually to step back and take a breath, that the chances of dying of this tumor is very small. The risk of death over 5 years is only about 3%, and the risk of death after 10 years is only 7%. But there are very specific management issues that need to be decided. And the way we treat thyroid cancer now is very different than we did 10 years ago. In fact, these methods are described in the American Thyroid Association guidelines for thyroid cancer and nodules. And it really has a series of steps that must occur. First, you need to do preoperative evaluation of the patient. In general, that's going to be a neck ultrasound. The second is decision on the extent of thyroid surgery. The third is, do the nodes need to be evaluated and removed? After that, we have to consider whether the patient should have radioactive iodine remnant ablation, followed by whether they need long-term follow-up in terms of thyroglobulins and ultrasounds.
So it sounds like there's a lot of information, a lot of steps that sort of go one at a time here. There's a lot of planning that has to go on and a lot of doctors being involved. But even early on, Dr. Berman, she was worried about this issue of thyroid hormone replacement that many people do. So we're going to talk more about this later on, but on this first visit, what do you tell people about thyroid hormone replacement and those issues?
The thyroid hormone that we use to replace these patients is pure L-thyroxine, which is converted normally into T3 and then feeds back on the pituitary gland to modulate TSH. So the hormone that we give and the subsequent conversion is essentially the same as a normal person. And given the normal thyroid function test that we aim for in some of these patients, we wouldn't expect any adverse symptoms to occur. In patients with higher risk disease, we may want TSH suppression, which we're going to be discussing further, but in those patients, there may be a slightly higher risk of heart problems such as atrial fibrillation and bone loss. But things such as weight gain would be unusual, and the patient should feel fine on this medication.
So in general, we're very reassuring that most of the time we can get you through this, put you on some thyroid hormone pill, and you'll generally feel very well. So once we've come to an agreement sort of about what these initial steps would be that Dr. Lee talked about and sort of reassured folks that they'll probably feel fine on thyroid hormone, we frequently turn to this discussion about the future. Questions like, will I see my children grow up? And what's my risk of recurrence? And am I going to need additional treatments? In those issues, how do you respond to that? And how do we sort of stage and let people know what are those risks likely to be and what's likely to happen for each patient?
We use many different staging systems to determine the outcome for our patients. The ones that people have heard of are AGES and AIMS and MASIS, but the American Thyroid Association guidelines recommend using the AJCC TMN staging. And the reason is this is a shorthand method of saying what is the extent of disease that a patient has. And it's universally accepted, whether you talk to endocrinologists, surgeons, or international physicians. But the problem is it doesn't really tell us about recurrence rates. For example, a 40-year-old woman with a 2-centimeter thyroid cancer and 6 positive nodes, she's a stage 1 patient. She is not going to die of the disease, but she's actually at moderate risk for recurrence. So the things that we look at, and the ATA has recommended that you also do a risk assessment in addition to the AJCC staging, and the elements that are not in the staging are things like aggressive histological subtypes. For example, tall cell carcinoma, sclerosing variant of papillary carcinoma. The second thing is we look for extrathyroidal or extranodal extension into normal tissue. Also, we look for lymphovascular invasion. Those elements do predict an increased risk for recurrence. One of the newest things that we've just figured out in the last few years is genotyping is very important. There's a certain type of mutation within papillary thyroid carcinomas called BRAF. And when you have a BRAF positive tumor, the chances of local invasion and local nodes is very high, and you should adjust your treatment regimen based on those things. We use all of these together to determine and help our patients determine what their risk is of death, what their risk is of recurrence, and then to individualize their treatment pattern with those risks.
So it's a little complicated. When we're talking to somebody about the risk, we have to talk about what's the risk of dying of thyroid cancer, what's the risk of recurrence, what's the risk of needing another treatment, what's the likelihood those treatments will be successful. So I think sometimes it's confusing because it's not just one risk that we're talking about. Dr. Berman, we talked about this initial risk assessment, but obviously sometimes we guess wrong, that over time things change when you're following a patient. How do you sort of determine as you're following somebody if we need to either lower or raise our initial risk assessments? How do you do that?
The standard methods of follow-up include, of course, history and physical exam and a good neck exam on a periodic basis, perhaps every 6 to 12 months for the first 5 to 10 years, given the individual case. In addition, there's an excellent tumor marker called serum thyroglobulin, which is made by thyroid tissue, especially in this circumstance, malignant thyroid tissue, and we use that to monitor the patients as well. Periodic sonograms of the neck are also excellent to detect recurrent disease, especially if it's involving lymph nodes near the thyroid bed. In low-risk patients, we continue to monitor them with periodic sonograms and thyroglobulin, and if any of those are abnormal, we will pursue them more aggressively. In higher-risk patients, in selected patients, we might consider other studies, such as an I-131 scan. Of interest, these I-131 scans used to be performed much more frequently than we're performing them now, but in high-risk patients, it's recommended perhaps a serial, or at least an individual I-131 scan may be useful for picking up disease. In addition, CAT scans, perhaps of the chest, and rarely or unusually CT PET scans may be useful in patients who have high risk of disease, or there's some suspicion of recurrent disease, such as an elevated thyroglobulin level or distant metastasis.
So we're tailoring our initial treatments to the risk of the patient, and we're tailoring our follow-up to the risk of the patient's treatments as well, in terms of how they're gonna do and likely tests that they may need. Before we move on to our next topic, let's look at this interactive question. In patients with papillary thyroid cancer, radioactive iodine remnant ablation should be routinely recommended for almost every patient, selectively used for patients at significant risk for recurrence or death from thyroid cancer, or rarely used except in the most high-risk patients. Now, let's go back to Lisa. After she had her thyroid surgery, she describes her experience with the radioactive iodine therapy.
I was told prior to surgery that I would have to undergo radioactive iodine radiation. I had no idea what that meant, but I knew that I would be under the care of an endocrinologist basically for the rest of my life. I was told that I would have to go to the nuclear medicine department of my local hospital and that I would have shots. And then on the third day, that I would take a pill, radioactive iodine, And then I would go home and need to be in seclusion for about 5 days. Fortunately, I didn't have a terrible experience with the radioactive pill. I wasn't nauseous. I was just tired. When you have to have radioactive iodine radiation, there is a process to it. And during this whole process, you're on a low iodine diet, which is very easy.
So after thyroid surgery to remove the thyroid cancer, many patients receive radioactive iodine. Dr. Berman, as little as 10 years ago, it seemed like everybody got radioactive iodine after their diagnosis for thyroid cancer, but it looks like now we're using it much more selectively than we did in the past. Can you talk a little bit about which patients are likely to benefit, maybe as importantly, which patients are likely not to benefit, and how do you make that decision with an individual patient?
Thank you. Radioactive iodine was first given approximately 70 years ago, but we're now just beginning to understand exactly which patients would benefit and which patients might not benefit. The American Thyroid Association guidelines, as well as other studies, give some information regarding which patients might benefit. For example, a patient that has a small papillary thyroid carcinoma that's between 0 and 1 centimeter in size, without any worrisome histologic features, probably should not receive radioactive iodine therapy and they would not benefit. Patients who have a little larger tumors, between 1 centimeter and 4 centimeters, without any worrisome features, such as vascular invasion or worrisome histology, such as tall cell variant, may be given radioactive iodine with a very selective approach, utilizing the characteristics that I mentioned to decide which patients would benefit from the therapy. Patients, on the other hand, who have a papillary thyroid carcinoma that's more than 4 centimeters, generally should receive I-131 therapy, as the studies suggest they might benefit and would benefit from that approach. Patients who have lymph nodes that are positive, especially in the lateral neck, it's controversial whether they should receive radioactive iodine therapy, as it depends how extensive the lymph node involvement is and how much papillary cancer is found in those patients. There, we would recommend a selective approach for those patients. And patients who have metastatic disease outside the thyroid gland should receive I-131 therapy, as it is known that they will benefit with decreased recurrence and decreased mortality.
And so it's gotten a little more complicated the last few years about which patients we give radioactive iodine and which ones we don't. I find the American Thyroid Association guidelines helpful because they do define some patients very specifically that may not benefit versus the ones that do. Dr. Lee, there's clearly a group of patients we help with radioactive iodine, and there's clearly a group that doesn't need it. Then there's this group in the middle that it might or might not benefit. To make the decision in that group, we really need to understand about the side effects. So can you speak, you know, realistically, what are the side effects from a dose of radioactive iodine? What's likely to happen? Those issues.
There are actually acute side effects, those side effects that happen right away, and side effects that happen later on. So the acute side effects seem to be dose related. So the higher the dose, the higher the chance of having a complication. Those include loss of taste, swelling of the salivary glands, and some nausea, usually almost never with vomiting. They're very brief and will go away within days. On the other hand, the long-term complications include intermittent swelling and pain of the salivary glands under the cheekbone and under the jaw, which can often lead to dry mouth. It doesn't sound like it's a very complicated problem, but actually chronic dry mouth will cause sores in the mouth. People cannot speak without drinking water. They cannot eat without drinking water. And actually, more importantly, it induces caries and tooth loss. So patients are actually very uncomfortable with those chronic complications. The ones that physicians fear the most is the concept of second primary malignancy. That is, after the thyroid cancer has been treated, that the treatment with radioactive iodine has been associated with increased risk of both solid and blood malignancies. We think that the risk is actually very small, that the risk perhaps is only about 14 patients in 1,000 that are being treated with radioactive iodine. I have to say that I've actually followed my patients very carefully and have never seen a second malignancy, and I've been in practice for 25 years. So I think the bottom line is that if you have a high-risk patient, a stage 4 patient, they definitely need radioactive iodine. The ATA guidelines actually feel that most stage 3 and 4, so those with lymph node metastases and invasions, should be treated. It's the 1 and 2, so the small intrathyroidal tumors, which one should they be treated? And then that's when we use the other characteristic that Dr. Berman spoke about.
So it seems like we're every day in the clinic faced with this challenge of which patients may benefit, which patients may not benefit, and trying to balance that risk and benefit, which I think is a decision and a discussion we have to have with the patients because it's individualized, and the ATA guidelines call for selective use, and I think that's good. Now, it seems like every patient that we see has done lots of reading about how we prepare for this radioactive iodine ablation. Dr. Berman, can you briefly just tell me about sort of the two major ways that we get ready for radioactive iodine ablation?
The time-honored manner of preparing a patient for a radioactive iodine scan and therapy, in which we have to have an elevated TSH, is taking the patient off L-thyroxine therapy, putting them on perhaps T3 for a short period of time, but for a period of time, perhaps a week or two at least, they become hypothyroid and may have some of the symptoms of hypothyroidism, especially in older patients, such as tiredness, lethargy, inability to concentrate, and may not be able to work effectively. And since approximately 13 or 14 years ago, we've had recombinant human TSH available for diagnostic purposes. Only over the last 3 or 4 years have we had recombinant human TSH available and approved by the FDA for raising the TSH and as adjunct to I-131 therapy in patients for quote-unquote remnant ablation, which really means local disease or patients who only have residual thyroid tissue left in their thyroid bed. The FDA has not approved recombinant human TSH adjunct with I-131 for patients with metastatic disease, although you published a nice article recently in the JCNM, and we have similar studies. Your study indicated that using recombinant human TSH for patients along with I-131 therapy for patients who have metastatic disease had a similar morbidity and mortality as did patients who were withdrawn from medication, and we have a similar study showing progression-free survival is similar using both methods. So in general, we've switched to use most patients with stage 1, stage 2, and probably stage 3 disease for using recombinant human TSH. Ironically, the patients who might have the most trouble with hypothyroidism with L-thyroxine withdrawal are patients with metastatic disease who are older, and in those patients it has not yet been approved by the FDA to use recombinant TSH adjunct.
So I think it's clear now that either option is reasonable for selected patients. One of the differences folks worry about a lot, actually, is if they have to stop their thyroid hormone pills, they're going to feel miserable. If I use the shots, I feel great. The truth is probably somewhere in between that. Can you realistically talk about the experience patients would have with one approach versus the other?
Yes, I've actually done thyroid hormone withdrawal for scans and therapies for 20 years, so I have a really good feeling of how patients feel, and they are miserable. They're really tired. Some people, as Dr. Berman says, really, really can't think. Most patients do prefer the recombinant human TSH treatment, adjunct use of it for both the diagnostic scanning and therapy. There are some drawbacks that patients need to know about. First of all, when you do the injections, it does require 2 additional visits to the office for the injection. The cost of the drug is pretty substantial. And finally, some people get side effects from it. It's very uncommon. They may actually get a flu-like syndrome with myalgias, but there's been studies looking at objective quality of life measures, and patients do better with the recombinant human TSH injections.
It seems like, Dr. Berman, that back when you taught me how to do this, we took people off the pills for 6 weeks. Now we stop their thyroid hormone pills perhaps for shorter periods of time if you're not going to use the recombinant human TSH approach. Have you tried that or found that effective, or does that make any sense?
There are several articles recently that you don't have to be off L-thyroxine for a full 6 weeks. And generally what we have done in the past is stop the L-thyroxine 6 weeks before the scan or treatment and then give Cytomel T3 from 6 weeks to -2 weeks and then nothing for the last 10 to 14 days, which really extends more than 10 to 14 days when you consider the actual time of the scan and treatment. We've been able to cut that down perhaps a week to 7 to 10 days, because we just want the TSH to be above a certain level. Historically, we've said the TSH should be above 30 microunits per mil, and as soon as it is, we can go ahead with an I-131 scan and treatment. However, there are recent studies, including from our group, that have indicated the older patients may not be able to have a TSH above 30, so in maybe older patients, a TSH above 20 would be adequate before we go ahead.
So it's nice now that we do have two options that we can choose from for individual patients that I see is often in most situations are fairly equally effective, obviously excepting the distant metastasis story that we talked about. So very reasonable. We had talked about the TSH issue, getting it high to do treatments and scans, but alternatively we have to talk about getting the TSH low for the follow-up to prevent recurrence. So let's look at another interactive question as we move into this section. Following total thyroidectomy and radioactive iodine remnant ablation in a 25-year-old woman with a 2.5 centimeter papillary cancer and a perithyroidal lymph node metastasis, the goal TSH level during the first 2 years of follow-up is less than 0.1, 0.1 to 0.5, or 1 to 4. Now, let's look at our last clip of Lisa and her story.
When I was told that I had to have my thyroid removed, I was also informed that I would be on a hormone replacement for the rest of my life, and that hormone replacement would do the functions of the thyroid. I was fine with it. For me, it was an experience, and I needed to be very patient to finally get on the right amount of a hormone replacement. The way I understand it, the body has to ease into the dosage. You can't just go full on and say, here's what you need, this is how much of it that you need. Everyone's different. Every thyroid cancer patient needs a different amount. 3 years after my surgery now, my levels continue to go up, down, and all around. You have to learn to live with it. You have to learn to know that you're not always going to feel the same. But it's always a process. This is why I wanted to share that story. My quality of life in the big picture is absolutely fantastic. I was diagnosed with thyroid cancer. But now I can happily say that I'm a thyroid cancer survivor.
So Lisa is clearly grateful and happy to be a thyroid cancer survivor and is still dealing with the issues that all these patients deal with over time. During the first year or two of follow-up, because we've got her through basically the first 6 weeks or so of the surgery and she got radioactive iodine, we generally keep folks on a slightly higher dose of thyroid hormone pills to decrease the recurrence. Dr. Berman, what goal TSH should we be aiming for? How long should we keep it? Those sorts of issues.
The goal TSH in someone who has persistent disease, by any of the criteria that we've mentioned, should be less than 0.1 microunits per mil, and you should continue that as long as there's evidence of disease. If the patient has high risk of disease recurrence, but there's no specific evidence by thyroglobulin or sonogram or physical exam that there's disease present but at high risk, the TSH is generally kept slightly low, between 0.1 and 0.4 microunits per mil. In the patients who have low risk for recurrence and have no evidence of recurrence, you can actually have a normal TSH in the 0.5 to 2 or 3 microunit per mil range.
So just like we were doing with the decisions for surgery and radioactive iodine, we're once again tailoring the intensity of the thyroid hormone pills to what we think either their likelihood of having disease is now or the likelihood of it coming back, which I think is terrific for individualized patients' care. Now, fortunately, most of our patients do very, very well and live very long, productive lives as thyroid cancer survivors. However, a few of them will develop a recurrence. So, Dr. Lee, what's your usual follow-up for the sort of the what's next step after we're through the surgery and the radioactive iodine, what do you do for that first 2 years?
So actually, the first thing that happens after someone has surgery is to put them on the suppressive doses of thyroid hormone that Dr. Berman talked about.
Right.
But Lisa was right. Every person requires a slightly different amount of medication. It depends on the body weight. It depends on how efficiently they absorb thyroid hormone. So it does take a long time. The half-life of thyroid hormone is 7 to 10 days. So every time you make an adjustment, you really need to wait 6 or 8 weeks. So that's why she says it took a long time to get her levels to where they are. Part of the first 2 years is training my patients to take their thyroid medicine. Actually, it's very new data that suggests that you really must take it with an empty stomach, and there are so many things that interfere with its absorption, including fiber, calcium, iron, many things that our patients are on already. So it's part of it as an education that it is critical to keep their levels stable, and it is an important part of their thyroid cancer treatment long term. Now, thyroid cancer recurrence can happen years and years later. The good news is patients don't die of thyroid cancer because it grows so slowly. The bad news, it can take 50 years for the tumor to come back. So in general, over the first, if you look at the people who will have occurrence, only half of them will have them within 5 years. Most of them will be in the first 2 years. So that's when we're going to really hone in and look for recurrences. And what I do is physical exam, as Dr. Berman pointed out, but a lot of patients will do is a thyroglobulin while they're on thyroid hormone. If after radioactive iodine therapy, that goes to zero within the first 6 months, it's going to be very unlikely that they have recurrence. And I'll continue to check those thyroglobulins over the next 2 years, maybe every 6 months if it's a low-risk patient. I will repeat a neck ultrasound, usually around 6 months or a year, and probably every year after that, because we know that together, the thyroglobulin plus the ultrasounds are the most sensitive method of finding recurrence. There are some patients, especially those who had nodal metastases that took up iodine, that I might repeat a whole body scan with radioactive iodine, either I-123 or I-131, but it is really becoming a much smaller part of our armamentarium to follow patients with thyroid cancer.
So it sounds like our practices are very similar. That first 2 years, patients are seeing us about every 6 months. We're measuring thyroglobulin, the TSH. One or two ultrasounds that first year, and we go from there. Dr. Berman, where do we go after that? We've made it to the 2 years. There's no evidence of disease. Everything is perfect, as Dr. Lee outlined. What's the long-term follow-up of the patient?
We certainly tailor our approach based on the individual patient and the risk factors that we've mentioned. And further, the guidelines and the studies are silent, are mostly quiet on how long these patients should be followed and what duration. So I'd like to give you our approach. Our approach is if they have high-risk disease with evidence of recurrence, at least in the past, we follow them closely at least twice a year for the first 5 years, maybe once a year from 5 years to 10 years, and then periodically thereafter. If they have low-risk disease, we see them with no evidence of recurrence, we see them a little less frequently. However, this is an ongoing process, and we're not sure exactly how to follow them or for how long. Most of our patients want to be followed for indefinite periods of time, even if there isn't much risk of disease, and we are happy to do that.
Yeah, and I think as Stephanie brings out, that part of the reason to follow once a year is to check the thyroid hormone levels anyway, because they'll be on the hormones for a long, long time. So we've discussed just a few of the many decisions that face both patients with thyroid cancer and their healthcare providers. Before we close, I'd like to ask each of you for any last words of wisdom or thoughts before we close. Dr. Lee?
I think what's important to understand is that the management of thyroid cancer really has gone from one treatment for all patients to something that really must be individualized. Mm-hmm. I think the best evidence that we can use is what's listed in the 2009 revised American Thyroid Cancer Guidelines, because it really did try to use the best evidence at the time it was written. What's important is it tells us how aggressive to be with patients who have high-risk tumor. But actually, even more important is telling us which patients don't need a biopsy of that nodule, which patients don't need radioactive iodine, and methods of treating with that radioactive iodine that reduces whole body exposure, example, using lower doses of radioactive iodine and recombinant human TSH. I think that's have been a huge benefit for our patients, and it does mean that doctors must really sit down and think about the guidelines and to treat their patients individually.
Dr. Berman?
I certainly agree very completely with the idea that we use the guidelines from the American Thyroid Association, for example, to help guide our therapy, and that we individualize our risk assessment for each patient. That's very important advance over the last several years. In addition, it's important, as I'm sure you both do as well, to have interaction of a multidisciplinary team and approach, and to discuss very completely with the patient and work their views into the management as well. And lastly, I think the future will depend a lot on many more studies, but also will depend on molecular analysis of some of these tumors, so we have a better idea how some of these tumors and why some of these tumors develop and metastasize where others don't.
Yeah, I would pick up on your point, Ken, about having multiple doctors involved in this decision making. And back when everybody got the same treatment, all of us were on the same page. And now when we're selectively doing treatments, it's really important that the surgeons and the nuclear medicine, the endocrine doctors, are all giving the patient the same advice. It's very confusing if we're arguing. And that can be a challenge for us because we're all sort of doing things slightly different.
I think another thing that we're doing different is that we're reassessing the patient every time we're seeing. So even though they may have been high risk at the beginning of their treatment, they actually can turn into a low risk. And we're starting to understand some of the testing that we do, which can then predict long-term survival without the tumor. And I think that's really exciting that our new data is helping us reassess patients and changing what their status is.
Absolutely, and focusing not only on just finding that recurrent disease for the patient that had recurrence, mm-hmm. but for the first time, finding the cured patient who's likely to do very, very well without additional therapy. Well, I would like to thank you both very much for your expert insights and comments. Thank you for participating in this CME CE activity. To proceed to the online CME CE test, click on the Earn CME Credit link on this page. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Evidence-Based Strategies for Treatment and Surveillance of Differentiated Thyroid Cancer, a Patient's Perspective. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.